Picture this. It's the summer of 1942, somewhere on the Eastern Front. A German soldier is on watch, standing in the dark near a fuel depot or an artillery position. He's been in this war long enough to know when something is wrong. Then he hears it. Not an engine. Not a roar. Just a whisper. A soft whooshing sound, like silk moving through air, like something gliding over his head in total darkness. Then the bombs fall, then the fire starts. By the time anyone knows where to point a searchlight, there's nothing there but night sky and the smell of burning. The Germans had a name for what was doing this to them. They called them Nachthexen, night witches. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we're going to talk about one of the most remarkable aviation units in the history of military flight. Not just remarkable for what they did, remarkable for who they were, what they flew, and the conditions under which they flew it. Pull up a chair. Before we get into the story, today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight, first solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now the story begins with a woman named Marina Raskova. Raskova was already one of the most celebrated aviators in the Soviet Union before the war even started. In 1938, she served as the navigator on a long-distance record flight in an aircraft called the Rodina, which means motherland. The crew flew 4,000 miles nonstop from Moscow to the Soviet Far East, setting a women's world distance record. Then the fuel ran low over the taiga and the plane had to make an emergency landing in a remote marsh. Raskova parachuted out separately because there was no room in the nose for her when the plane came down. She landed alone in the Siberian wilderness and spent 10 days in the forest before she was found. The Soviets made her a national hero. She was the first woman ever awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union Gold Star specifically for aviation achievement. She had Stalin's direct attention. She'd met him at the Kremlin. She had the kind of access that most people in the Soviet system could only dream of. When Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June of 1941, Raskova began receiving letters, hundreds of them, then thousands. They came from women who wanted to fly in the war. Women who were already licensed pilots, women trained as navigators, as mechanics, as engineers. The Soviet aviation clubs that Stalin had promoted aggressively through the 1930s had turned out a generation of trained aviators, and a significant number of them were women. The Soviet military wasn't entirely sure what to make of all this, but Raskova had Stalin's ear, and she used it. By October of 1941, Stalin signed the order, three all-female aviation regiments would be formed. The 461st Fighter Regiment, flying the Yak-1, the 587th Dive Bomber Regiment, and the 588th Night Bomber Regiment. That last one is the one the Germans couldn't sleep because of. Now, if you want to truly understand what the 588th accomplished, you have to understand the airplane they flew, the Polikarpov Po-2. Polikarpov was a Soviet aircraft manufacturer, and the Po-2 was their two-seat biplane designed back in 1927 as a primary trainer. Wood frame, fabric covering, fixed landing gear, open cockpits, no radar, no radio navigation in the early years, no guns on most of them. Maximum speed somewhere around 90 miles per hour in still air. A strong headwind could stop you in place. By 1942, this airplane was obsolete. It was the kind of machine you used to teach student pilots how to make coordinated turns. It had no business being in a shooting war. The 588th took it into a shooting war. The Germans were flying Messerschmitt 109s. The performance gap between a Mi 109 and a Po-2 was so enormous that if a German fighter pilot wanted to intercept a Po-2 at night, he had to be careful about slowing down too much. The Mi 109 stall speed was faster than the Po-2's cruise speed. That is not an exaggeration. The German pilot had to fly at the absolute edge of his aircraft's low-speed envelope just to match pace with the thing he was trying to shoot down. That sounds like an impossible situation for the women, flying the Po-2, and in some respects it was. But that performance mismatch also worked in their favor in ways nobody anticipated. A slow, low-flying fabric biplane at night is very hard to see, very hard to track with ground-based weapons, very hard to intercept with a fast-moving fighter whose guns are calibrated for crossing speeds measured in hundreds of knots, not tens. The Po-2 could fly extremely low without stalling, which meant the crews could hug terrain in ways that faster aircraft simply could not. Here's the operational profile that the 588th developed. They flew only at night, every single mission under cover of darkness. Their targets were German supply depots, fuel dumps, troop concentrations, railroad lines, artillery positions, and headquarters facilities. The kind of infrastructure that keeps an army group moving and eating and fighting. Each aircraft carried a crew of two, pilot and navigator. The navigator was also the bombardier, which in a Po-2 meant leaning over the side of the open cockpit and releasing the bombs by hand at the right moment. The bombs were small by Second World War standards, 50 to 100 kilograms typically, but they were accurate because the POTU flew low and slow, and because the women who navigated those airplanes were very good at their jobs. The tactics they developed were creative and effective. They would fly in groups of three aircraft. The first two planes would make a diversionary run directly over the target. Draw the searchlights, draw the anti-aircraft fire, draw every eye on the ground upward and forward. While the Germans were shooting at planes 1 and 2, the third aircraft would cut her engine. Just switch it off, go to idle or full off, and glide. In a POTU at night with the engine off, there is almost no sound. What you can hear if you're standing on the ground and the airplane is directly overhead is the wind moving through the rigging wires. The struts and bracing wires that hold a biplane's wings together make a soft sound when air passes through them. A whispering, whooshing sound. German soldiers on the Eastern Front described it as the sound of a witch's broomstick sweeping through the sky. That's where the name came from. They weren't being dismissive. They were describing something that genuinely unnerved them, something they could hear but not see and could not seem to stop. The pilot would hold her glide until she was positioned over the target. The navigator would release the bombs. Then the pilot would restart the engine, push the throttle forward, and run for it in the dark. Restarting a POTU engine in flight was not always a sure thing. Sometimes it caught on the first try. Sometimes it took a moment. That moment, hanging in silence over a German anti-aircraft battery, had to feel very long. Each crew typically flew between 8 and 12 sorties per night. On the short summer nights at those northern latitudes, when darkness was limited, the women pushed the pace harder. Some nights, an individual pilot flew 18 sorties before the eastern sky began to lighten. Think about what that means in practical terms. You land. Your navigator crawls out and helps rearm and refuel the airplane while you run through your checks. You take off again before the engine has fully cooled. You navigate to the target in total darkness, drop your bombs, navigate home in total darkness, and land. Then you do it again, 8 times, 12 times, 18 times on a busy night. The conditions inside those cockpits were brutal. Open cockpits in a Russian winter mean exposure to air temperatures that can drop to 30 or 40 degrees below zero. The women wrapped themselves in whatever insulation they could find, newspaper under the flight suit, every piece of wool they could source. Frostbite was common and constant, particularly on the face and hands. The parachutes issued in the early months had been cut down from men's parachutes, adjusted as best anyone could manage. If you had to jump, you hoped the adjustment held. At the low altitudes the regiment typically flew, there wasn't always enough air below you for the canopy to fully open anyway. No cockpit heat, no canopy on most configurations, no pressurization, no ejection seat. Just you and your navigator and the cold and the dark and whatever was rising up from the ground below. The maintenance situation in the early months was equally improvised. The women of the 588th maintained their own aircraft. Mechanics who also flew, armament crews who loaded bombs in the dark and then went up and dropped them a few hours later. They worked without lights when a blacked-out airfield required it, by feel, by memory, by the kind of intimate mechanical knowledge that builds up when you've rebuilt your airplane, dozens of times with your own hands. Let me give you some names, because this story deserves them. Nadezhda Popova. She flew 852 combat missions. She started flying the POTU operationally in the summer of 1942 at age 19. She flew through the North Caucasus, through Ukraine, through Poland. She was shot down twice and crash-landed far more times than that. Each time she got back into an airplane, awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union in 1945. When she was interviewed years later, she described the fear honestly and without drama. She said that on a good night, when the clouds were low and you could use them as cover, you might feel something close to confident. On a clear night, when the searchlights were strong and the German guns were accurate, the fear was with you from engine start to landing. She flew anyway. Irina Sabrova flew more than 1,000 combat sorties. 1,000. She holds the record for the most missions in the regiment. 1,000 individual nighttime combat sorties in a fabric biplane, and she came home from all of them. Yevdokia Bershanskaya commanded the regiment for most of the war after early commanding officers were killed or reassigned. She wasn't one of the flashy personalities by accounts from her crews. She was the kind of commanding officer who kept the operation running and running correctly. The regiment functioned because of her steadiness. Marina Smirnova flew 868 missions. These numbers are not outliers. They're representative of what the regiment's most experienced pilots accumulated over 3 years of continuous combat operations. The losses were real. 30 pilots and navigators were killed in action. When a German night fighter caught a POTU with incendiary rounds, the fabric aircraft could catch fire very quickly. At the low altitudes the regiment typically operated, there wasn't always room for a parachute to deploy even if you could get out of the open cockpit in time. The regiment lost crews to mid-air collisions during diversionary runs over heavily defended targets. They lost crews to weather, to navigation errors over featureless terrain in the dark, to mechanical failures in an aircraft pushed far beyond its designed service envelope. When a crew was lost, there was a brief ceremony at dawn. Then the remaining women went back to maintaining the aircraft and loading the bombs and preparing for the following night. Now here's where it gets interesting, at least to me. When you add up the full scope of what this regiment accomplished, the numbers are staggering. The 588th Night Bomber Regiment, redesignated the 46th Guards Night Bomber Aviation Regiment in 1943 when it earned Guard status, flew approximately 23,000 combat sorties over the course of the war. They dropped an estimated 3,000 tons of bombs. They flew from the summer of 1942 through the final weeks of the war in May of 1945. 23 women from the regiment were awarded the Hero of the Soviet Union, the highest military decoration in that country. 23 from a single regiment. Marina Raskova, the woman who fought to create these regiments and bring them into existence, did not live to see the end of the war. In January of 1943, she was killed in a weather accident. She was leading a formation to a new airfield and flew into high terrain in fog and low visibility. She was 30 years old. She received a state funeral, and her ashes were interred in the Kremlin Wall. After the war, the Soviet government let the story of the women's regiments gradually fade from public discussion. Cold War priorities called for different kinds of heroes. In the West, almost nobody knew this had happened. It was largely through the work of researchers beginning in the 1980s that the full record of the 46th Guards became accessible to a wider audience. The American author Bruce Miles documented the regiment in 1981. Aviation historian Ann Noggle gathered the surviving pilots' own accounts and published them in 1994, a book that remains one of the essential sources on what actually happened out there on those dark Soviet nights. What stays with me as a pilot is the airmanship. These women navigated at night over blacked-out terrain with no radio navigation aids, no moving map, no approach plates, no glass panel. They used dead reckoning, compass and clock, landmarks memorized from maps studied by daylight. They found their targets in the dark, over contested, poorly mapped territory. They dropped bombs accurately enough to justify more than 20,000 sorties. Then they found their way home in the dark and landed. No instrument landing system, no approach lights in most cases, a few hooded lanterns to mark the runway if they were lucky, and their own judgment of height and speed and sink rate in the darkness. That's airmanship. Old school, from the gut, nothing to bail you out airmanship. You know your airplane, and you know your limits, and you trust the training and you fly. The next time you're airborne at night, and grateful for your integrated avionics and your GPS approach and your traffic display, think about the 46 guards. They didn't have any of it. They had a compass, a clock, and the discipline to cut the engine over the target and glide in silent through the dark. Sources today include Soviet military archives, Ann Noggle's 1994 documentation of the regiment's survivors, and research from the Russian State Military Archive. More from the hangar at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger. 3,000 tons of bombs in a fabric biplane at night. We'll see you next time.